My name is Doris, and I'm a hospice chaplain. I'm honored to be here this evening to address you. First, let me say that we're very fortunate to have this organization and the selfless efforts of all involved. They give so generously of their time to make it possible for us to come together and hear and learn about near-death experiences. A hearty thank you to all of you, Craig, Bill, and Bob, sitting right here, and Judy, who's on the board, who's sitting up there, and thank you to my two co-panelists. Tonight's focus is on shared death experiences, but please allow me to tell you a little bit about myself and about hospice. I have been involved in hospice care for 30 years. For the last 4 years, it has been my great privilege to serve as a hospice chaplain. Some of you may be familiar with the hospice program. You may have had a family member or a friend who has benefited from hospice care. Without going into quite great detail, hospice care is provided and paid for by Medicare and also by many private insurance companies. Basically, persons who suffer from a terminal illness and are not expected to recover are eligible for services from a team of professionals such as doctors, nurses, social workers, CNAs, volunteers, and last but not least, CNAs and chaplains. The aim is to provide comfort and care for the patient and family when there is no hope of cure or recovery. My reason for attending these meetings is that I have had great interest in near-death experiences and what happens to us after we die. Dying involves deeply personal issues, and what we can learn about death may make an important difference in the way we live our lives and may actually make it easier for us to face our own death. I have learned so much from every presenter that has shared his or her story before this group. What I noted is that they are not looking for validation of their experience. They all have one thing in common, and that is an inner strength and conviction and a certainty that their near-death experience was real, that it was life-changing, and they are no longer afraid to die. In my work as a chaplain, I talk with people about death and dying on a regular basis. People who are suffering, have a terminal illness, or have been told by their physician that nothing else can be done, and that is just that it's just a matter of time. Needless to say, it is very difficult for a patient as well as the family to get this kind of news, especially if the patient is relatively young. The people I work with, the majority of the people of my patients are elderly, but that doesn't make it any easier. Not only does the patient and the family have to cope with the physical decline, there often are spiritual and religious issues and questions that come to the forefront. Emotions and personal feelings can add to the stress, and a chaplain can be very helpful at this time. Concerning religion versus spirituality, as a person, and more importantly, as a hospice chaplain, I respect each person's right to choose to believe, what to believe, or not to believe. We each are on our own spiritual journey. It is not up to me to pass judgment on any fellow human being. My God asks of me not to judge, and above all, to love my neighbor as I love myself. And my neighbor is everyone I come in contact with. Many of my patients are firmly grounded in their faith. They have lived their faith their whole life long, totally trusting in the goodness of the Lord, and are ready for the transition to the spirit world. Then there are patients who have lived in their particular faith, or who have lived their particular faith their whole life long, but when confronted with the inevitable, when facing death, they have questions and doubts and are not at all sure that heavenly rewards await them. Their fear is that they were just not good enough, and they are afraid to die. And there are persons who, for reasons of their own, no longer practice their faith and want no part of organized religion. They may or may no longer believe in God or in a supreme being, but may be morally upstanding individuals and live by the golden rule: do to others as you would like to be done to you. The golden rule is found in many places in the Christian Bible and also in the scriptures of nearly every religion in the whole world. I'm a practicing member of my church, but I also believe that there is not one true religion, as some religions teach. I believe there is one God, or you may call him creator or supreme being of the universe, and he transcends all religions, all faiths, that we are called to have compassion and love and serve one another. It bears repeating that, as a person and more importantly as a hospice chaplain, I respect each person's right to choose to believe what to believe or not to believe. We each are on our own spiritual journey, and it's not up to me to pass judgment. It is my personal understanding that of the billions of people that live on this earth today, all the people that have lived and died in the past, and all the people that will follow us, each and every one of us is unique, and we each have a unique purpose. There is no one now, or no one that will ever be identical to you. Your physical body, your intellect, your emotions, and the spiritual part of you, all of it is unique to you. And the all-important fact is that you matter, and your Creator loves you unconditionally, just as He has made you. And that, for me personally, is the basis why I must not pass judgment on others. I simply cannot know all about another person. As a person and as a chaplain, my first obligation is to accept and respect each person without judgment, to look for the good in everyone and respect their journey, listen to their life story, acknowledge and validate their uniqueness, be a friend, and hope that together we explore any questions, doubts, or fears that they may have as they near the end of their life's journey. And now I would like to tell you about a shared life experience. I was assigned a hospice patient who was very ill with serious upper lung and upper respiratory disease. I call him Tom. He was in his 70s and in a nursing home. On our first meeting, when I introduced myself as the chaplain, he told me that he was raised and later married in the Mormon faith, divorced, then married his second wife in the Catholic faith, and divorced after some 15 years. He said he believes in God, but that he has his own understanding of Him. Then he said, with all the energy he could muster, that I was welcome to visit with him, but he does never want to talk about religion again. I thanked him for his honesty, told him that I supported him and respected his right to his belief, and I said I would be very glad to visit with him. During my visits with him over the next few months, I found him to be a kind, honest, hardworking, morally upstanding man with a good sense of humor who loved his family above all. Tom had one great regret. He said he started smoking at an early age and for years smoked 2 to 3 packs of cigarettes a day. He knew that smoking caused his illness and was now cutting short the precious time with his family. Though his marriages did not last, he was a loving father to his children. He was especially close to one of his sons who had a serious illness from the time he was 1 year old, and the illness required daily treatments and maintenance. Tom did it all for his son. He personally took care of his son's medical needs until the son was in his teens and was able to do it himself. The son grew up, had a home and a lovely wife, and when Tom was no longer able to live by himself because of his illness, The son and his wife took him into their home and lovingly cared for him for a number of years until it got to the point where Tom needed nursing home care. Tom's condition deteriorated drastically. The son and his wife and other family members were at Tom's bedside when it was clear that Tom's days were numbered. One night, the son and his wife returned to their home after a long stay at the nursing home. Exhausted, they went to bed soon after. At about 2 a.m., suddenly both woke up, sat up straight in bed, and were looking at each other, startled. Then they both felt like someone was blowing a big puff of cigarette smoke right in their faces. Neither of them had ever smoked cigarettes, but they well remembered the unpleasant cigarette odor that always surrounded Tom during his earlier cigarette smoking years. The son got up, checked all the windows and doors to make sure that they were closed, and there was no cigarette smoke coming from outside. For a minute, they even thought there might be a burglar on their porch having a cigarette before breaking into their home. It was raining heavily outside, but everything checked out fine. They were puzzled. There was no explanation. They tried to go back to sleep, but shortly thereafter, they received a phone call from the nursing home informing them that Tom had just passed away. The son and his wife were in awe. After they collected themselves and thought about it, they just knew that it had to be Tom saying goodbye to them in a special way just before he died. And when the son shared this with me the next day, he was still very emotional, but also very happy knowing that his dad loved him so much to say goodbye to him before he passed on. The son said that if anyone had told him a story like this the day before it happened, he would have said they're crazy. He would have never believed it. However, he knows now that things can happen that just cannot be explained rationally. Thank you.
I met Katrina as she spent her last days in the Air Force, right before she got out. She was an unusual woman. She has these capabilities. She was taking 27 semester hours between two colleges, working full-time in the Air Force, was the young women's president for the stake, and was dating me. I don't know how she fit all that in, but she did somehow. She made it work. She had another characteristic that was kind of odd. She would know about some of her patients when they died in a very visible manner immediately.
The stories that Craig is talking about were things that I thought were common. I served in the United States Air Force during the latter part of the Vietnamese War, and we ran an air evacuation mission between the countries involved in the actual combat, Vietnam, Laos, Thailand, and in the Philippine Islands, which was where the hospital was that I lived in, that I worked in. There were a few times when I would see the person after they passed away. I thought that everybody could do that at that age. I remember a New Year's Eve when my girlfriend and myself were planning on attending a dance, and we walked to somebody's house before going to the dance. And when we got to the house, we were standing in the driveway, and I asked my friend about this man who was standing behind her. I described him. The weird thing about it was that I could only see his top half. She gave me his name, and she said, "That was my last patient tonight. He passed away in the intensive care unit just before I got off shift." Perhaps a better example of a shared death experience would be something that happened to me in 1968. And I don't know why I would see things like this when I was younger. I know I prayed hard that this would go away, and it did. But in 1968, my sisters and I, well, I have three sisters, were walking around the house in our baby doll pajamas, like kids do. It was a Tuesday night, and we retired to bed. My parents went to bed also, But my mom was really nervous, I noticed. She made sure every window was locked. As a preface to this, our family had been struggling with what we call a sexual predator. We left the younger girls and their brothers at home one day, and my sister and I, who were older than these younger children, went shopping with my mother. And while we were gone, a man came to our house and said that he was looking for apartments. And instead of going away when they said, well, this is a home, this isn't an apartment, he walked straight in. And one of my sisters says that he took her under the table and told her that if she told anybody, he would kill her mom. Meantime, the oldest sister took the baby and says, I have to go get a diaper for the baby. So she went over to the neighbor's house, and the guy caught on that she was telling, and he took off. Well, in 1968, they treated sexual predation differently than they do nowadays. I did a 50-year research review on this. I'm a doctor in the field of human development. What they did was put them in mental institutions rather than in the jail. Everything that I read that was in this whole 50-year comprehensive body of literature showed that people actually believed that when a young girl was victimized by a pedophile, that it was either her fault or her mother's fault or the pedophile's wife's fault. That was kind of the context where this occurred. And it so happened that this guy was one of our neighbor's brothers. We got the police involved, and they told us there was nothing that they could do because he resided at the Utah State Hospital. And I can remember thinking, oh, that's not a good idea. And every time this guy would come home, like every couple or 3 weeks, we would find like cans of dog food in our yard. Or we would find bricks that were stacked up so that he could look in our windows. He was a voyeur, one of the things that he did. I only actually saw him drop from our window one time. I was terrified. I was sleeping with a shotgun. I was so terrified I was sleeping with a shotgun. And so I took the shotgun, and I woke up my parents, and I went out the front to see if I could see where he went. And we had a great big field by our house, and so he stood up under a light so that we could see him, and then he disappeared into the field again. But I only saw the top of his head because it was a brief shot, so I knew that he had brown hair and that he was Caucasian. So this particular night in 1968, my mom has all the windows locked up and was kind of edgy, but we all went to bed thinking everything was okay. And it was about 11 o'clock when I woke up, and I had this feeling that there was a man crouched down by my nightstand, which was adjacent to the bed. And I looked, and I was right. There was a man crouched down on his haunches, and he got up, and he had his hands like this. They were all the fingers were opened. He was trying to be scary, and he was doing a good job. I can remember that he was wearing black, and I got a very good look at his eyes and his nose and his mouth and his facial expression. And he was even making a noise that I could hear, kind of like an ah kind of noise. And he was coming after me. He was lurching at me like this. And my sister woke up while this was happening and she said, I'll go get Dad. So she ran to my parents' bedroom and got Dad. Well, this guy is coming at me making this noise, and he looks like a person. I thought it was a person. And when my dad got to the doorway, this man walked through the wall into the bathroom. When I described him to my mother, she said, that sounds like the man who has been threatening us and peeking in our windows. And she said, I wonder if he died tonight or something. And I thought, that could be what just happened here, and I wonder if there's going to be a picture in the paper in his obituary, because I got such a good look at his face. The next morning, our neighbor called and told us that we didn't have to worry about this man bothering us anymore, because he had passed away about 11 o'clock the night previous. So I thought, well, that doesn't surprise me. I wonder what that obituary is going to look like. And when the obituary came out, he had a picture on it, and it was the same face. You couldn't miss it. His nose was just like Jimmy Durante's. Huge, bulbous nose that really distinguished him. As I reflect on the experience, I just remember the terror that I experienced. there was a bad part to it. This is one of those warm and fuzzy shared death experiences. But like Doris was talking about, it was so real. I knew the guy's name. I saw his picture in the obituary after he died, verifying that it happened. The police have reports on him. This was not a case of what, you know, mental health people we would call schizotypal personality disorder. This is something real that is well documented. One of the good things that I got from this is I directly observed that there is life after death, for sure. Not only is there life after death, but in this case, this person was able to scheme, and he had the ability to carry out his plan. And he had the same desires that he had prior to death. He would be classified, from a psychological point of view, as a pedophile, or somebody who has a sexual interest in children. While we do call that a crime now, we are also realizing that it's also a mental illness. And so I look at it a little bit differently than I did back then. So, Doris, I really appreciated your remarks about not judging people. I have never heard of an experience like this before, but I know that it happened to me. I don't know how to explain it. It just happened to me, and there's good reasons. There's things that I learned from it, and then there's also that terror part. And I appreciate the opportunity of being able to speak with you tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you, Katrina. We just found Victoria a couple of days ago through one of our other board members. Jeff told me about his connection with her on a phone conversation with Ians. She has had a shared death experience with her daughter.
Yes, thank you. It's so nice to look at variations of myself looking back at me. Yes, I met Jeff Olson in December of 85. He spent time in Scotland and I lived there at that time. We lost contact for a couple of decades. Communicating with his mother, I shared some things with her on another experience where I was outside of my body and beyond, and I was wondering what her response would be to that. And she emailed me back and she told me that Jeff had the same experience. There's no such thing as a coincidence. There's no such thing as an accident. I just moved to Utah last week and life is beautiful. What I'd like to share with you this evening is the first very wonderful experience I've had in this lifetime. The second was an out-of-death experience, but that'll be for another time. 16 months prior to my daughter's death, she was diagnosed with an astrocytoma in the brainstem. The brainstem is what allows the body to respirate. Without that being operational, there is no breathing. 3 weeks after, my daughter's name was Paris. 3 weeks after she was diagnosed, I was diagnosed with cancer also. I had breast cancer. At first, the attention was nice, but that wore very, very thin. I don't like pity. I was very angry at what was going on in my family. Especially, I prayed that God give me the cancer, save my baby girl. And I did, I got the cancer, but I still lost my baby girl, so I was very angry. I lived with much guilt. During that 16-month period, Paris became more obvious as a person in our little home. I was a single mom, myself and Paris and her sister, Davine Faith, who was just 13 months older than her. It was very hard for her, having her mom and her sister both diagnosed with cancer. During that 16-month period, Paris shared some profound things with me, but not by saying, mummy this, mummy that. She lived as she was dying. She was very happy. She was excited to know that she was dying. She couldn't tell enough people that she was dying. Many times when Paris was, I thought, asleep, I believe Paris was in some other place. She did spend a little bit of time in St. Jude's. She volunteered to do many protocols there that would have no benefit for her, because she made it very known that she is going to die and that it's okay. But she was a very willing guinea pig. She's even been suited up in the research center there, and she was watching her own cancer cells in a petri dish, a slide dish, and she's just telling everybody all about it. And I was angry because I needed to grieve because my child was dying. I couldn't understand why she was happy, and it was, I even got to the point, I felt angry. I called it my screaming room. I went through my bathroom into my closet, and I kept a pillow there where I could scream. I needed to console her, to console myself, but she wanted no consolation whatsoever. I could write a whole book about that 16 months, but I want to jump to the date of her actual death. Paris became very, very paralysed, and this was a little girl who had enjoyed gymnastics. She played piano, she'd done ballet tap, like all little girls do. And she got to the point where she would wiggle on the floor. She didn't want carried, and she would laugh and call herself a little caterpillar, and that would just tear me apart. It would tear me apart. But that morning, her sister, Davine Faith, who we call Faith, she was off to school. So it was Paris and I, and Paris had made it very clear that when it came time for her death, it was just she and I. He was very definite about that. And that morning we got her bathed, drying her. She told me that today's the day for the pyjamas. We had ahead of time bought very nice pink pyjamas, all lacy, and she was going to keep them for this special day when she died. And she told me that morning, this is the morning, my pink pyjamas. And I had said to her, I said, but you know, these were the special ones. She says, yeah. And this was Valentine's Day. All she spoke about for the rest of the day was she was going to get her Valentine from this little boy called Harrison. She was hanging in there on Valentine's Day. She had the pretty pink pyjamas on, and she wanted to be up in her bed for the first time because she would normally be on the couch. And, of course, by this time, her face is very squint and twisted with a paralysis. Then went inside. The day went on, and Davine Faith came home from school with a big bag full of valentines. We sat on Paris's bed and we read all the valentines, and that one from Harrison was there. Very soon after that, her father had come by. We were divorced, but he decided he couldn't stay. I felt to ask him to take Davine Faith with him to his apartment, and I would call him when the time was right to call him. So it was just Paris and I. This was in Texas, but even February in Texas, it can get cold at night. Initially, I had the heating on, a very small house. As the evening wore on, Paris would go in and out. She would open her eyes and she'd smile. And she'd close her eyes, and I didn't know what was going on. Of course, I just expected the room was all pretty, nice linen on the bed. My baby would just maybe lie there and fall asleep and just die in her sleep. We had previously had hospice engaged in what was going on, but Paris really came into her own during that 16 months. She made it very clear, just you and me, Mommy. Just you and me. That was part of my guilt. When I realized I had cancer, I thought all cancers were the same. They're not. Different cancer cells do different things. I made it quite clear to my doctors that I needed to keep my cancer so that Paris would be free of hers, right? That was the deal, wasn't it, God? Initially, I decided I was having no cancer treatment whatsoever. So I was given about 6 months to live. And Paris was given 9. And she says, no, Mommy, you need to be there for me. You need to be there for me. I had a lumpectomy, clear margins, and 4 6-week rounds of radiation. And Paris was having radiation at the same time. And we would get stuck in the bathroom door many times, the two of us, trying to get to the potty at the same time to throw up. She taught me many things. towards her death, one that was very important that I share with you. I was in college at the time. I was a late starter. I wanted to be a full-time mommy, and I was. And I was going to the local community college, doing a history class and two or three others, which I dropped. But Paris was insistent I keep the history class because she loved the history. She loved reading it with me and questioning me. She'd always tell me, "I'm your teacher, Mommy." And we'd read passages from this history book. Then we'd get to the summary at the end. Then she'd ask me the questions. And then I couldn't quite get them right. And she'd say, "Mommy, you're not paying attention." And she'd say this to me many times, to the point I'd say, "Excuse me, young lady, you're talking to your mommy." She's, "Yes, but you're talking to your teacher." During this period of time, I became very ill. I guess you could call it multiple psychosomatic illnesses. I was very, very ill. And I kind of let my appearance go because it was even hard to bathe. And Paris said to me one day, "Mom, you're not wearing any of your Gucci skirts anymore and you look a mess." I thought, okay. So I'd done the best I could. I got the hair fixed. I tried to put on the makeup, a nice dress. She's, "Okay, you get a 6 out of 10. "Okay." And this was just the week before she died. So I made a better effort next day. "Okay, 7 out of 10. And what did you get for your history?" "Well, I only got a C." "Mom, you're not paying attention." Well, I got up to maybe the day before she died. I got a 9 out of 10. And my goodness, I was wearing a sequin dress that day. I still only got a 9 out of 10. I was getting hurt because I knew my baby was passing soon. And I was wondering, what am I lacking that I can't get a 10? To the point I'd be in tears, but not in front of her, in the bathroom. So I went to her room and I sat there and I said, "Honey, can you tell me what Mommy needs to do to be a 10 out of 10? Because I wanted to be a 10 out of 10 for her." She's, "Mommy, you can't be a 10 out of 10. You can only be a 9. Because when you're a 9, Mommy, you've got room to grow and you will grow. If I give you a 10, you've nothing to grow for. So what would be the point?" And I sat there and I thought, out of the mouths of babes, what a profound thing. But I knew this wasn't my 10-year-old daughter talking. It was a voice that came from deep in her of many things she shared. And there's not time to share all of that this evening. But when it came close to Paris's death that evening, I had to turn the heating off because it was just getting too warm. So the heating was off and the room cooled down. And she's somewhat going in and out. The room is getting hotter and hotter and hotter. Okay, I opened the window to let some of the cool night air come in. Still, the room was getting hot and hot. I turned on the AC. I mean, who turns on the AC in February? I turned on the AC. As time moved on, that AC was as cool as it could go. The house was like a refrigerator, except for Paris's room, which was like an oven. I was pretty sure that Paris had closed her eyes for the last time. Her heart was beating very hard and profoundly loud. This is not what I expected to happen. It was scary. I could hear her heart. It was like a clunking noise. Clunk, clunk, clunk. And it was very, very loud and audible. The room got hotter and hotter. And I realized that things weren't going the way I thought it would go. There wasn't going to be a peaceful end to this. She started gasping and thrashing on the bed, almost like someone having a convulsion. Initially, I laid on the bed with her and put my arm over her so she wouldn't fall off the bed. Her body movement was like this on the bed. And it was a twin bed. Well, this went on for a little bit. And I ended up sitting with my back against the headboard and holding her so she wouldn't fall off the bed. And her movement became quite violent. She wasn't conscious at that time. And the room only got hotter and hotter. I couldn't help thinking how merciless this all was. Wasn't it enough that he was taking my baby girl? But does she have to really suffocate to death? Do I really have to endure watching this? It went on for hours. The room got hotter and hotter. I managed to stand up on the edge of the bed and I put my hand up to the register on the ceiling. I thought, the AC can't be working. But when I put my hand right up to the register, I'm standing on the bed, it was cold. But the room was so hot. It was baking up. The memory of that scared me. It was almost like I was in a kiln in an oven. It was so hot. There was not a whole lot I could do for Paris. I knew she was suffocating. I got off the bed and I went to her door to pull it open. And her door, she just had a square bedroom. On this side there was a window, and on this side the sliding door closet and the door. And the door was set in the same depth as the closet. And I went to the door because I wanted to go get ice. I was going into the kitchen to get ice, a pitcher of ice water, whatever it was, because it was hot. And the door was concaved, and didn't make sense to me. It was concave this way, concave that way, kind of like the plane on the door on an airplane. I wasn't putting a great interest in that. I was too worried about what was going on with Paris and what the hell was happening. For me, it was my living hell. So I did. I ran through that hallway, and it was freezing. The hallway was freezing, so the living room was freezing, the kitchen was freezing. My big Rubbermaid thing there got filled with ice and with water. Run back through, grab all these handful of cotton washcloths back through there. It was so cold. Looking around the heat in the room. Made sure the door was open, the window was open, and there was drapery on the windows. But there was no breeze. There was nothing. The only place was heat. It was so hot. And I got back on the bed with her again. And I put washcloths all around her and drizzling water on her to keep her cool. And she's struggling to breathe. And there was nothing to do. I mean, she had perfectly good lungs. There was nothing wrong with her airways. It's just the brain stem had now, it was shutting down. The body was no longer to breathe, however. And the clunking of her heart, which I heard when I was in the kitchen, it was that loud. It was like banging something. It was unbearable. And as I was rocking her, I was facing her headboard in the wall, and generally at a right angle here. It was just curved like this, just a curve. And I'm rocking her, and I'm rocking her, and I'm looking around, and it's like that whole part with the door and the closet. This melded together. Like this was one. Oh, I'm inside a freaking ball. I don't care. I just don't care. And it's like, God, you're taking her. Just hurry up and take her. Don't let her go on with this much longer. And the bed, before I had straddled her like that, I was lying trying to prop her up. And if you've ever been in the ocean and you wade out into the ocean and the water's up to maybe your chest, and you feel that when the current comes in, you feel that rise, that strange feeling. That was happening when I was on the bed with her. I could feel the rise and the fall. The rise and the fall. It's like nothing made sense, because mothers don't hold their children when they're dying, not these days. So nothing made sense. I didn't care that the room was roundish, that I was inside the ball. I did care that I was boiling hot, and it ended up just getting the pitcher and pouring it over us both. And I rocked her, and I rocked her, and I rocked her. And then I heard the pop. It was like a balloon popping, but a muffled pop. And her little heart had stopped. And I just said, thank you, God. You know. And I laid her down like this, back on her bed with her head on her pillow. And her face was like that of an angel. The paralysis was all gone. And she's a beautiful little face. And I kissed her. And I laid down beside her. And I don't know if I dozed off. I don't know. Next thing I knew, that room was really cold. The room was really, really cold. And I dressed her. And then the hospice came and they pronounced her death. And I carried out more of her orders, and that was that she was not to be buried, to be cremated only. She was raised in a church where typically children are baptized by the age of 8. When the brethren from that Christian church visited her, no need to do that. It's like she knew everything. The strange thing was she thought Mommy knew and Mommy didn't, because Mommy was too bent out of shape with her own self-inflicted suffering, you know, because all suffering is self-inflicted. So she was cremated the same day that she died, and her ashes were to be on the sea, and that took place also. And 6 weeks after that, I joined her, where she reminded me again, she is, always will be, my teacher. I didn't put a whole lot of store on the changing of the room, the heat in the room, like, I don't know if it was ocean wave, or until I heard some of the speeches from our Dr. Moody. I thought, my God, that's what I experienced. And things have just progressed since then. But now, in retrospect, when I look back, that was a very blessed experience for me that I was allowed to have, that my daughter knew I was going to have. She made sure I lived to experience it. Her death was as traumatic as a birth. There was a purpose for Paris's life. I know what that was. She was a teacher to many adults. She knew that she was passing from this life. For her, it was just a big fat joke. But that night is, thank you, Paris, for sharing that with me.
Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
I can gather that there's at least one reason why shared death experiences aren't popular subjects in conversation, and that is there's likely some trauma associated with those experiences for the people who have been there. With every shared death experience that I've heard about, that's probably true. Some questions or comments, or maybe have something along these lines to share.
There's a guy I know named Chris who he had a dog named Oscar who he had to put down because he was old, and they were at the vet, and he, for some reason, he held his dog's body for like a half an hour, and Oscar's spirit came out of the body and merged with him and thanked him for all their years together and everything. And I was like questioning him, you know. It's like, well, it's all love, man, you know. It didn't stop him from being a secular atheist, which I thought was odd, but I thought that might be an experience.
I didn't quite get the culmination of the experience of Victoria, exactly what happened. I understand the change geometry is a sign of something happening. But in Raymond Moody's book, he has what would be called previously spirit visitations, or they could be called after-death communications. He gives an experience. He sat around the bed, stood around the bed of his mother when she was dying with other family members, and they all had the early part of her experience. I would like to ask Victoria to clarify what really happened. What was the shared death experience?
So you're asking whether this was a shared death experience or something else? I've got his books right here on shared death experiences. One of the first things that he mentions in this book is that there's the change of geometry, and that may be the only thing that you experience. A lot of these people experience multiple things, or in some cases you may experience one or two. He said that nobody experiences all of them. That's one of the things that he experienced with the passing of his mother, was that the room changed shape.
All I can say is when I had my own experience, when I left my own body, and when I left and went beyond, neither at that time did I go through a tunnel. I can only share with you what happened that night. I hope you can hear me. In retrospect, when I look back, the room did change shape. It became rounded. I was like inside a sphere. I was inside a ball. Okay, I've heard some people talk like an hourglass and a funnel up here. I don't know. I wasn't looking at the ceiling. All I know is the walls were all rounded. And the intense heat in the room, I believe that there were others there, because I was screaming for my grandparents, my late grandparents, my brothers. I believe there were other entities in the room that I could not see with these eyes. I believe that is the reason for the intense heat. That room could not be ventilated in any way. The rising and falling, the rising and falling, it's almost like we were breathing, like the room was maybe breathing. But these are the only things that I can share with you. No, I did not have a tunnel experience with Paris.
Did you have an experience of your daughter's presence at the time? Was this one you were holding her?
When I was holding my daughter, that's when I felt a sensation of rising and falling, along with the rounded room, with the heat in the room. But during that time, she's struggling to breathe, and the heart is clonk, clonk, clonk. At that time, I was very much a mother. I was very mortal. What was happening with the room, and the heat in the room, and the movement of the room, was all very secondary to me. It was like a nightmare for me at that time. So thinking of anything spiritual going on was the last thing that I was really thinking of. I was just thinking, this sucks. I ought not to be doing this. It's bad enough that I'm losing her. Why, God, aren't you taking her faster? Why? Ooh.
Would you mind telling us about the experience that you had 6 weeks later?
It was the day of Paris's memorial service. By this time, and of course I pretty much arranged that too, along with a good friend. We'd done the little invite thing, and we made sure the Circle of Life by the Lion King. Oh, she was very insistent that her memorial service was to be in her school, a place of teaching and learning. We wanted it in her chapel. No, in the school, Mommy. So we got permission to have that in this school, and that was Austin Independent School District in Texas. So we had that. She wanted no hymns, but she wanted Truly, Madly, Deeply was a song that she played constantly towards the end of her life. But you're not listening to it, Mommy. You're not listening to it, Mommy. Listen to my song. I wasn't in the mood for mushy love songs until I listened to the second verse that was played out loud at her memorial service. And it talks about being beyond. The song's by Savage Garden. Also, The Circle of Life from The Lion King. Tell the Mommy that they have to listen to the words. She was very definite. So we had the memorial service in the school, and we played the music that she requested loudly. People were told to listen. No one was to wear the colour black or brown. Everyone was to wear bright spring colours. And this was March 24th. Paris had wanted me to speak about her. I said, well, Paris, really, it's meant to be someone else. What about your teacher? She had the same teacher for 3 years. So my name was on the program, but her teacher, Sheila, was going to do it. Sheila never turned up. We'll never know why. I ended up eulogizing my own child. I was head to foot in tremendous pain. I had toothache and 28 teeth. I had earache in both ears. I was twisted almost as if I had arthritis all over my body. I had an Indian doctor, and she was there, and she told me all that is wrong with me, meaning all, was due to my grief and my guilt. They could only treat me so much because I still had to function, but I was in tremendous pain. I was almost crippled by pain. That evening, after the memorial service, I stood at the door of the gymnasium. It was held in the gymnasium to thank persons for coming. And everybody wanted to hug me. And I thought, my God, if one person hugs me, I'm sure I'm going to just die on the spot. I was in so much pain. I ended up excusing myself and someone drove me home. I managed to get myself onto bed that night, but I was in so much pain. It was almost like I was covered in burns. That's how much it hurt. I got myself on the bed and I lay flat on the bed, and it took me forever to get myself to lie down. I lay back on the bed and I realised the ceiling light was still on. I can't sleep with the light on. I'm going to have to get up off the bed, go across the room, turn it off. And it was like, after all I'd been through, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. I was like, I am not going on anymore. Oh, I was angry. Everything was coming through my head that had gone on from my childhood. Everything. And I was so much pain. That's it. I've had enough, okay? I do not want to be here anymore, not even for my little girl who was sleeping in the other room. And I was lying there in the bed, and it's like I couldn't cry, but there was hot, like hot water. I could feel it running out my eyes and in my ears when I was lying back. And I'm looking at the fan and the light. And the next thing I knew, this hand came into vision, and I looked. And I'm trying to pull my hands down, and they would not come down. The next thing I knew, with the tremendous speed, I didn't see it, but felt it, moving out of my body, over the top of the bed. The next thing I knew, I'm kneeling above the floor in an almost kneeling position, facing my nightstand. And I'm looking like that, and I see myself lying in my bed. And I felt okay with that. For some reason, I wasn't too surprised. And then I felt myself humming inside, almost like if you've heard an electric transformer, you know, on these old electric poles. I could feel like me buzzing inside. And then I moved backwards with tremendous speed. And this, I could see all this. I never saw anything till I was kneeling above the carpet. I moved backwards. I went through the bathroom door. I went through my vanity. Although I was moving in tremendous speed, I could see things almost in slow motion. I'm moving back with tremendous speed, but yet I could see things slowly with my eyes. And in the back of the vanity, there was a cardboard box and a long white I had been looking for a long time. It was Isatis body lotion. It was a slender white bottle and it was lying on its side. I could never find that, but I saw that. I moved through my other daughter's room and I saw her in bed asleep. The next thing, I'm in the hallway adjacent to Paris's bedroom, and I'm in an upright position. And there, although this house was in darkness late at night, her bedroom door was wide open and it was just flooded with light, the most spectacular light, and there she was. What was kind of strange to me though is just behind her was her dad. What's he doing there? He's alive. And she spoke to me and she said, well, are you ready? Like, she was expecting me. Are you ready? I said, yeah. And I walked into her and we put our arms around each other's waist. We took off, not upwards and not through a tunnel, like diagonally. But it wasn't for too far. And the next thing I knew, coming over this huge hill. To me, it was like Arthur's Seat in Edinburgh, where I lived. It wasn't a mountain, but a very high hill. And it was the luscious green grass. And we came down on the other side, and it was like behind Paris, there was a sea of persons, and it went back forever. And I knew that was all my ancestry. That was all of them. And we're moving along this path, and it was in the distance. It was going around the side of this building, or maybe we were at the side. Anyway, it was going to the side, around the side of the building. And it was like a white-on-white building, sparkly. It was really pretty. It was a shiny path, and it was beautiful. There were trees. Now, I could sit here and describe a meadow to you, but that doesn't even do it justice. It was a very beautiful place. And I just felt so content, so happy. And she was there. Her face looked a little bit more mature. And I could sense that she was a little Miss Know-It-All doing something there. There was two things I was to do. And I needed to go back. But it's your choice, Mom. You can go back. Come with me. Go back. But I'll wait here for you. I said, well, okay. Thinking that I was coming back to get something and be right back there. Next thing, I'm in my bed. It was so cold. Next thing I knew, I woke up. And it was daylight. And I was lying on my side. And the covers were all cut up around here. And the room was just full of light. A bit of sunlight. I felt so happy. So full of joy. There was no toothache. There was no earache. No headaches. No pain. And I'm up and it's yay! I thought, but what about her dad in the background? So I called her dad right there and then. Can't remember what it was, but something stupid, just to make sure this guy had not died in the night. I thought, how was that? Dashed through to the bathroom, hauled out that vanity, and there's the bottle of Acetes body lotion lying on its side, behind that cardboard box. I went through to my other daughter's room, Davy and Faith. She was still sleeping. And I'm walking out of her bedroom, and by her bedroom there was a bookcase. And on top of the bookcase was a photograph of the children's paternal grandparents on their wedding day. And Paris's dad, David, very like his own father when his father got married in his 30s. And walking out the door, and it's like, something hit me. It was like a hard puff in my face. The face that I saw behind Paris was the face in the picture frame. It was her grandfather. It wasn't her dad, it was her grandfather. And I was so excited. So I called David and I told him all about it. I said, I was so jubilant. Church was in at that time, I knew, but I called and left a message for my pastor because he was very concerned about me. Tell him, please come by the house. You know, I left a message.
Just two things real quick. I am a little worried about creepy people being able to just walk in and out of our houses. I'm just not looking forward to that. I'll try to live right, and hopefully that'll pan out. For Victoria, your daughter had a very unique approach to the news of her pending departure from Earth, which I really appreciated that outlook because we often just get all bent out of shape about it. How have you since come to appreciate her outlook on that?
The experience has left me, my own experience with her. I thought it was a one-off thing, but it leaves you with like a conduit. I have a knowingness that this life is like a board game. The real life is there. This is like sleepwalking in a dream. I'm looking forward to my death. I'm going to have a great time before then, but death, I don't know how each individual is going to experience in that few minutes, you know, that transition. But the real thing is beyond. This is not the real thing. And we are all one. We are not separate. We appear separate to these eyes. But you are just another expression of me. We are all Godness, omnipresent. We are all that.
I understood this was a part where we could share our own. So if you'll let me...
I would like to hear from you. Yeah.
Okay. With my mother, this is our shared death experiences. When she was in the hospital, we all were commenting to each other, "Can you feel the spirits gathering?" In other words, as soon as you reached a certain point near where she was, the first time she was in the hospital, it was like you went into this spiritual domain where there was unseen spirits there. The second time that she was in the hospital, when she died, my brother had a dream to return from his vacation, that what he experienced. My wife had a dream of the color of the coffin that she would be buried in. My mother told of visitations to my father for her to get ready. At death, we all commented again when we watched her pass away. There was a certain period of time when I commented, and I filmed this, and every time I watch this, I get this chill through my soul about, "Hey, can you feel the spirits gathering?" And we all commented that we were all sharing in on that. Now, with my nephew, when he died, before my nephew died, we started getting hints that, you know, TVs going on and off by themselves, radios going on and off. We thought, this is really strange. What's going on here? He also kept telling his dad that he was to get ready for that something would change the family soon. He prayed and talked to his deceased mother and said that it wouldn't be long before they were together again. His father heard his father tell him after he died in the hospital, "He's with us now." So he received a communication from him, "He's with us now." Because he was screaming, why? His nephew died at 31. When he passed away, I did CPR on him, and I felt his spirit up above me, and he communicated to me basically, "Hey, I'm having fun. I'm not coming back. This is great." So that was really interesting. Family members had dreams of him. That was another thing that followed. I felt him by my side before he was buried. Lights went on and off in different rooms, which was another thing that continued. Pictures of him were knocked off the shelves, and people experienced things being knocked out of their hand when they were trying to take like food or something to the couch. And I had this book of Elaine Durham's book that I was reading at the time that flipped off the shelf where it was onto the floor a couple of times. I thought that was kind of interesting. And we were all opened up to each other's feelings. We could feel what the person around us, everybody could feel what the person around us were feeling during that period of time. So that's my shared death experience.
I thank you all for coming.